Welcome to the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of June the 8th, 2020. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and your State Society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'll be your host this week as we'll be discussing various things that went on this week in the area of taxes. It's been an interesting week, and we got the long-awaited changes to the Payroll Protection Program. We'll also talk about a couple of other key developments, but obviously, the changes to the PPP loan program are the most significant thing we need to worry about, because those changes are important because a lot of things have been held up in the interim. And we also, unfortunately, as is always true as we do it with the stuff we've done ever since we first got these programs, they add a bunch of questions. In addition to maybe answering or solving some problems, we have a bunch of other things that have started happening because of this. But let's at least start with what might some may see as a good news, probably good news, but we'll talk about some cases where maybe it's not totally, and that is that the Payroll Protection Program Flexibility Act of 2020, which we'll refer to quite often here as the PPPFA, you know, we got an acronym for everything, it was enacted into law, and it was signed into law by the President on June the 5th. Now, the bill itself is a relatively short bill, and it makes specific changes to the PPP loan program, and that was a matter of a little bit of controversy about what the particular, especially one of the more significant changes there, impacts. It makes more significant changes to the PPP forgiveness calculation, and we'll talk some about that and how that goes. And it also, in the end, expands the issue of these deferrals that we saw under old age survivor and disability insurance. Remember, we had the right to have that would be kicked forward. We could kick that back to the end of next year and the year following for any of our employer amounts of those. Well, that's also been part of what we got under this bill. So we got that for everybody. So no longer does it matter if you got a Payroll Protection Program loan or not. That's not going to be the key issue we're going to look at to see whether or not you're going to be able, or I should say forgiveness, that will no longer drive whether or not you can actually receive a benefit from this. Now, many of you may remember there were two versions of this bill. We had a proposed fix that was in the Senate, and that the Senate tried to pass just before they left for their recess. And then we have a provision that was stripped out of the House HEROES Act, and that the House Representative passed. Well, in the final analysis, we ended up with the House bill. We ended up with that for a couple of reasons. Number one, as I noted, the Senate was unable to move its bill before it recessed. So, like it or not, the House bill was the one that got acted on. The House acted on their bill with their provisions, as opposed to acting on the Senate bill. And it's interesting, there were differences in the two bills. I don't know that we really had a lot of, shall we say, you know, friction over parts that were in each of them, and the other chamber found them unacceptable. But I do think the real problem became practically the way these things work and needing close unanimous consent, that once one House passed a bill, we were pretty much going to be stuck with that. So it's one of these things where had the Senate actually gotten a unanimous consent before they left town for the Memorial Day recess, there's a really good chance we would have had their bill. But since they didn't, and the House therefore went forward and passed their bill, that was one they were working on, that became the one that actually changed everything. So we do have a couple, though, of key issues that are involved in the act. So let's talk about what actually changed. And the first key change is we're going to have a change in the loan maturity rules. Now, you may remember, right, we're going to have now the new law that was passed sets the minimum period, the minimum loan maturity is going to be 5 years under this program. Previously, the law told us the maximum maturity, but it never told us what the minimum would be. And as you may remember, the SBA went into that uncertainty and said, well, for simplicity, we're simply going to make all of the PPP loans, the amounts that's not forgiven, we're going to set that up, and we're going to make that we're going to set that date to 2 years out. So if you had any part of your PPP loan that you did not qualify for forgiveness on, the balance was going to be due in 2 years. And it's going to be a 1% interest rate payable over 2 years. Congress decided that was too short. They didn't like that period. So what Congress has done now is expand it to 5 years. Now, this officially applies to loans made on June 5th, 2020 or later. So June 5th, 2020, it's date of enactment. Date of enactment, when you find that in any law, the date of enactment in a law is going to be the day the president signs into law, or if he doesn't sign it and he just lets it become law without his signature, it would be the day that that happened. But normally they sign them. And in this case, it was signed. So June the 5th became our date. So that's the date. However, nothing stops parties who have pre-PPPFA loans. You know, they got them at the beginning of the old program. They can go back and change the dates to be in line with this maturity. So we can go ahead and reset this so that we don't get stuck with a two-year loan. Now note, nothing in there says the bank or the borrower has to do this. So if you want to do it, the hitch is going to be, first, your client's going to have to want to make this change. And then secondly, the lender they're working with is going to be agreeable to making this change. That could get interesting because it's not clear if lenders will be agreeable to carrying a 5-year loan at 1% as opposed to just keeping the 2-year. Again, this is only for those things that don't qualify for forgiveness. And we're talking about taking a very low rate loan and holding it on the books. And while it's guaranteed, and we know that we're going to be paid the principal and interest by the government, if not by the borrower, it's still not the most, shall we say, attractive loan package if you're a lender for the amount you plan to keep on the books. So we'll see how much renegotiation, how much of that rewriting actually gets done. Now we have another issue here, and this was a somewhat controversial provision. The covered period for 1102. Now remember, one of the confusing parts about the Payroll Protection Program, the original CARES Act, was we use the term covered period multiple times. So in this case, we want to be very clear. The covered period we're talking about in this case is the covered period that is for the actual loan. This is under Section 1102. Under this rule, with this ending date for 1102 changes, in the original program, the ending date was June 30, 2020. Now it becomes December 31st, 2020. Now this affects, as I know, we'll find other changes that affect forgiveness, but this affects the basically PPP loan program. So this is the basic loan up front, ignoring the forgiveness side. So this goes from a June 30 date to December 31st. When this got for a vote in the Senate, Senator Johnson of Wisconsin was concerned about that. He felt that this indicated that you could go ahead and keep getting loans all the way through the end of December. And Senator Johnson did not want to vote for a bill that did that. So what ends up happening was he requested that they get a letter from leadership indicating that it was not the intent they were authorizing the program to continue through the end of the year, but rather, you know, they really intended to just be through June 30. His position was this was meant to be a short-term relief provision. Now, the catch is we just have a letter from leadership saying, yeah, that's what we intended. The problem is, though, with no change to the underlying law, I'm not sure what he really got except probably a little bit of cover for voting for this thing, even though he felt like he shouldn't vote for it because it was an expenditure. He says, well, look, I got this, and hey, you know what? They didn't tell me the truth. If it turns out that these programs get extended beyond this date. Yeah, I expect that that's some of the changes we're going to see. Now let's go to the meat of the bill that I think a lot of your clients are more interested in, and that is the changes to the forgiveness program. And this case, yet again, we have, as I said before, another covered period. So this is not the covered period we just talked about, although some of the dates look the same. This is the covered period for forgiveness. So the covered period for forgiveness is the time period you have to spend the money. Right, you receive the money and you have this long to spend it for appropriate uses and get full forgiveness. Now the covered period is going to end on the earlier of. It used to be 6 weeks from the date that you received your money. So it used to be that you had to go ahead and get rid of your money within 6 weeks if you didn't spend it, or I should say 8 weeks. If you didn't spend it within 8 weeks, then you didn't get forgiveness. But now it's going to be the earlier of 24 weeks after loan funding. Or December 31st, 2020. Now, we concentrate on the fact that this is how long we have to spend the money. And certainly that a lot of borrowers were complaining that, you know, in essence, I've been ordered to be shut down. I'm not open. You know, I can't do anything. How in the world can I spend this money aside from paying people to do nothing? Now, as I've said before on this program, honestly, the original intent of this program was to have people paid to do nothing. It was meant to be a substitute for unemployment and keep people tied up with their employer. However, that was never well communicated to the public, shall we say, in this program. And Congress didn't feel like they wanted to say it that way fundamentally when we got further into the program. But there is a hitch here. The covered period does not only cover how long you have to spend the money, and they didn't change the law. So the covered period also becomes the period you need to maintain your full-time equivalency numbers, and also the period you need to maintain your pay rate or your, you know, salary rate for the employees. That may make this a little less helpful in some cases, because previously I just had to keep those numbers up for the 8 weeks. Now I got to keep them up for 24. Now the good news now is that I can use December 31st as my restore to date. And obviously, if I can meet the restore to rules, then it doesn't matter if it's 8 weeks, 24 weeks, 52 weeks, doesn't matter. And like I said, the 24 weeks, remember, there's one other key issue of 24 weeks. We are not getting more money. So it's not as if they're giving us more money to spend over 24 weeks to enable us to keep our FTE numbers up. Rather, they're still giving us the same basic number, but let's say you hold it for 16 weeks, you spend it the last eight, because you're going to use it for your reopening, and that's what you're concentrating for, and by then you're allowed to reopen. You still got those 16 weeks where you had no employees that are going to weigh down your PTE. One other thing to remember. Now, I talked about the restoration. This is the quirk in the law. You need to check and make sure that you or your client has to check and make sure that you're actually eligible to even worry about restoration. Remember, you have to show a decrease in FTEs from what you had on February 15th of 2020 to what you had on average per week over the period from February 15th, 2020 to April 26th, 2020. If in fact you don't have a decrease there, if you didn't bring it down, if you didn't actually start laying people off or reducing numbers until after April 26th, you're not eligible to do the restoration. You've got to meet the 24-week now FTE and pay rate numbers, not the 8-week. The restoration rule will not help you. Now, because of that, if you got a loan before this program was changed, well, in that case, then maybe you want to keep the old rules. And in reality, the law does allow you to do that. If you have an existing loan, you got one before, June the 5th of 2020, you're able to say, you know, I don't want 24 weeks, I want 8. Assuming that you or your client did go out, they got the loan, they said, look, the rule is we got to spend the money. They have spent the money over the 8 weeks, and now they don't have funds that they can use from the loan to help them reopen, and or they know they can't qualify for restoration, you're going to want to use the 8 week period, not the 24 week period. Now, this 8 week period is not available, at least as I read the law, seems like pretty clear from the law, it's not available to anybody who gets their loan from this point forward. So if you've got your loan now, you're going to be on a 24 week period. You need to understand before you go in, do I qualify? You know, did I have that reduction in FTE from February 15th, 2020's FTE numbers, full-time equivalents, not full-time employees, full-time equivalents, to the period from February 15th to April 26th. If that number did not go down, you've got to maintain the FTEs through the entire 24-week period, or you're going to have a reduction in the amount of your forgiveness of debt, at least unless you qualify one of the other new relief provisions we'll talk about here. But that's an issue. The other problem that people are pointing out with this program, if you actually played by the rules with the original loan, you understood the rules, you understood what they clearly were aimed at, and you went out and you paid all your employees for doing nothing for 8 weeks, tough luck. Nothing in this bill is going to allow you to get more funds. The only real good thing you got out of this bill, to be totally honest, if you're in that position, is that you at least can get the old age survivor and disability insurance deferrals after you get forgiveness of indebtedness. And maybe you got the forgiveness of interest. We're still not clear on what Congress meant by one provision here. We'll get to that here shortly. But, those who took out the loans up front, they probably have some reason to be upset with this law, at least feel like that they basically are being punished because they took this seriously. People who just got the money, sat on it, held it, said, I'm not following those rules, they're being rewarded. We'll see how that plays out, because I'm sure a few people start noticing that over the next few weeks, and we'll see what Congress does at that point, because Congress is purely in a reactive mode. Whoever's yelling at the moment tends to get the action. Now, there is a special rule that is in here, basically because it was pointed out to Congress that we're having issues these days. We can't get employees back. There's the issue we can't get employees back due to the fact they won't accept rehire. Or, to be honest, in many cases, we're being asked when we reopen to do things like social distancing that's going to reduce. If you're a restaurant, you had so many tables, right? And you have so many people you see. And if you've been in the average restaurant, you don't have a lot of room between you and the table next to you. Never did, right? Because that is a key determinant of how much money the restaurant can make. You know, their rents and everything are based on how many people, how big, what area they've got. And they need to maximize the number of tables in order to maximize revenue. Now, when they're asked to come back, what's going to happen is that, they can't do that. Or you've got the unemployment problem. Through July 31st, employees may be better off on unemployment. This is going to kind of simplify that. Or you may just have an employee, let's say they work for you during, basically they work for you during the period. But they're not on unemployment. They just got another job offer. They left town. And now you can't find somebody to take their place, and you're having issues. Well, Congress is giving us some relief in that case. So first thing is, both of these affect only the full-time equivalent calculation. If you meet either of these requirements, we're going to effectively take the employees affected out of the calculation. The first one in play looks at, if I can document in good faith that I was unable to hire certain employees who were there on February the 15th, 2020. So remember, our key issue here is we have to show that we cannot hire people who were there on February 15th. That could be good news or bad news, but that's the date they're going to go. And you also have to demonstrate that you were unable to hire similarly qualified employees by December 31st, 2020. That's the restoration date. Now look, this is an imperfect answer because, as I noted, the restoration date is kind of, it's an issue. But at least this opens that up for you. So by December 31st, 2020, I can't rehire employees. If I can, I'm out of luck. I mean, I've got to hope I can't find anybody if I'm in this mix and I can't use a restoration rule. But, we'll see if they fix that. I think, to be totally honest, I believe the restoration rule is horribly broken as currently written. I understand why they did it the way they did. But the problem is that you're asking people who you're penalizing for having a reduction in the 24-week period, you're penalizing them because they didn't cut employees before everything started. If you held on to people as long as you could, you're being penalized. And that does seem kind of weird. And when you look at it from a policy standpoint, you wonder, what's the policy point? But nevertheless, we're stuck with that. Now, there is a second relief option. And this one is probably one that a lot of companies may have to avail themselves of, especially if, we hope this does not happen, but if we do see a second wave of, coronavirus, and we don't see that we have the vaccines, and so we're having to have major league social distancing applied all throughout the year, so restaurants never get back to being able to get all those seats back in operation. Well, this will provide some relief in that case and let you at least get your debt fully forgiven. So if you can show you cannot return to the same level of operations due to governmental guidelines related to social distancing, sanitation, or some other COVID-19 safety requirement. So this helps you because if you are looking at the issue of where due to COVID-19 issues, you've got this restaurant, but the state tells you that in order to reopen, you have to maintain social distancing. And so you do that and you maintain your 6 feet of distance. And that means you take out like half of your tables or 2/3 of your tables are gone, whatever you need to get that 6 feet of separation. This will enable you to say, look, I couldn't restore operations and I was short on the full-time equivalency because I couldn't do this. Now, again, it's one of those quirks where if we develop the vaccine in December, right? And, you know, we've got all these things. I mean, I don't know how this works if in fact they say, oh, by the end of the year, it doesn't matter. Or let's flip it a little bit here. In a lot of places, these 6-foot deals are recommendations. Now, however, these recommendations, they say, you know, follow CDC recommendations. Well, that's great, except if you follow the recommendation, that's not really a government. I guess it's a guideline, so we'll hope they'll count that as a guideline. And you'll be able to, you know, cause yourself to, you know, not pick this up. But the problem is, you know, that it may be a little bit easier if the state orders you to maintain that 6 feet than if it's just suggested. And right now, it is still in the CDC guidelines, so I'll cross my fingers that we'll be able to use that regardless. Because here's the other hitch. Even if, let's say, like the state of Arizona does not mandate that 6-foot separation in a restaurant, you may find that you're liable to the insurance carrier saying, if you don't maintain that 6 feet of separation, we're not protecting you. So if that's the case, then, you know, we're looking at that differential, and that's why it's important as to how they look at this guideline routine, you know, what exactly counts. Now, there's another big change here, and this actually will get into part of this. We have the minimum use of loan proceeds for payroll costs. And this one's odd because this one could be good news or bad news for you. And I say that because what we're doing is we're going from a cap on the amount of total forgiveness and switching over to a mandate of minimum spending of proceeds. Now that's key because under the old rule, even if I can only spend 10% of my PPP loan funds on payroll costs, which is unlikely that's all you could do, but let's say that was all you could do, I would still get cancellation of debt for, you know, 13.33% of my loan, as long as I spent 3.3% on other qualified costs. In essence, I was fine, and I would have to repay the rest, but it wasn't really a problem. Now we're going to lower the level, but at the same time, we're going to put it in there as a hard and fast rule. So again, under the original program, we had a forgiveness amount limited to 75%, right? So if you had 75% of, and I should say, of the amount of payroll costs. So if I got a loan, you know, we'll go an example here in just a second as to how that worked and what would happen. Now, the new law is changing this so that you must expend 60% of loan proceeds to qualify for forgiveness. It is clear this is a cliff test. This was what Senator Rubio was objecting to in the House bill initially. And he thought it was a drafting error, he said, and that they could get it corrected. But going back and forth, it becomes very clear, and Senator Rubio later in tweets makes it clear, that no, this was intentional. That apparently in the negotiations, the House started with a bill that had no cap on payroll costs, that said you could spend it just on qualified expenses. That apparently got pushback from certain locations that wanted to force it, said that, no, it was a good idea to force it on payroll costs. So the compromise was you could lower it, but you had to make it mandatory. Now, in reality, for people, this could be either good news or bad news. If you were having trouble getting to 75%, but you could get to 65%, or you were like the self-employed person who was sitting on that crazy couple hundred bucks under 75%, well, you know, you basically can get full forgiveness. We're back to where that can work. But if you can't get to 60, Under the old rules, you could still benefit. Under the new rules, you won't. So let's take a look at a couple of examples specifically on this issue. And the first one is, you know, this is under the original forgiveness test. We have Aero Inc. obtains a loan of $100,000 under the PPP loan program. And during the covered period, it would have been 8 weeks originally, Aero Inc. spends $60,000 on payroll costs and $40,000 on other allowable costs. Let's say it was rents, right? This is the kind of thing, we had significantly high rents in a lot of major cities, especially in places like New York City. Under the original rules for forgiveness, Aero would have been forgiven $80,000. The $20,000 would have become repaid over 2 years, but I would have gotten 80% of my loan forgiven. I got that because under the original program, as the PPC, or as basically, as the SBA finally decided, well, this is what we meant, you just took whatever you spent on payroll costs divided by 0.75, and that's when it became your max forgiveness. Now, under the new rule, same fact pattern, Aero would qualify for full forgiveness. They did spend 60% of the original loan proceeds on payroll costs and use the remaining fund for other covered costs. So, great. Instead of getting $80,000 in this fact pattern, they got $100,000 of loan forgiveness. And remember, this is a minimum. I've had this question multiple times. Nothing stops you. They could spend 100% of their loan proceeds on payroll costs and they would get full forgiveness. Spend $100,000 on payroll costs. It's not like we're going to somehow not knock you down and say, oh, sorry, you spent more than 60, so you got to pay back 40. No, you can spend every single dollar on payroll costs. You could do that under either program. But your problem is, of course, if you end up a dollar short now, you end up with no forgiveness. Previously, if you were a dollar short, you end up with just, you know, a partial and a very minor disallowance. In this case, as I said, change it by $1. Instead of $60,000, Aero spends $59,999 on payroll costs, $40,001 on rent. They have to repay the entire loan. Now, of course, assuming they took their loan out after this law was changed, they'll have 5 years to do it at 1%, but they got to pay $100,000 back. And so be careful if you have somebody, you know, we're no longer going to get that waiver that says, you know, no matter how badly you do on spending payroll costs, we're going to give you at least forgiveness of payroll costs effectively plus 1/3 of whatever you spend on payroll costs if you spend it on other allowed items. So, you know, that's one of those issues. Finally, this will be a benefit even to those that did everything under the old program. We're going to extend the deferral period for payroll taxes. That's assuming you want to do it. And as we talked about when this came out earlier, the IRS has decided that you don't have to do this deferral, right? And the deferral, right? Oh, we should say, actually, this is the wrong one. I've got ahead of myself. This is the deferral of principal, interest, and fees. Previously, we had a deferral period of about 6 months. Now we're going to say you go get your PPP loan. We're going to not ask you to pay in principal, interest, or fees, any fees related to the loans, until at least the date the forgiveness amount under 1106 is remitted to your borrower. So that means before that can happen, you're going to end up applying for forgiveness. The borrower is going to consider it. They're going to give it to the SBA. And as we mentioned previously, that could be 150 days if both the borrower and the SBA take maximum time. During that period, we're still not going to charge you for principal and interest, right? You won't have to be making payments on this loan until we decide the level of forgiveness you're going to get. Now, it appears to me now that it's still not clear if we get the interest. And, you know, it's still weird. And I think the law still says we don't. But yeah, it's just one of those things. Don't be surprised if we have a few more adjustments to this. Now, you might think, well, then great. I'll just never apply for forgiveness because I think, as I mentioned to you earlier in the earlier things, there's nothing in here that tells us a deadline to apply for forgiveness. Now we actually do kind of have one. So we can't just sit there and hold back and don't ask for forgiveness and say, hey, it's going to keep everything going for a while. Rather, if you fail to apply for forgiveness within 10 months of the end of the covered period, and since this is under, you know, we'll have to kind of look at this, but we have at least 10 months to go after the covered period ends. And remember, the covered period ends 24 weeks in, or it ends at the end of December. In any event, we've got quite a while. So we can, at least for 10 months from the end of the 24-week period, we can sit there and not have to pay principal and interest, because we don't have to, as long, and if we apply for forgiveness at that end of 10 months, we may get another 150 days. So we could be sitting well over a year before we have to make any payments on these loans, to the extent of anything that's not forgiven. Now, we'll still have to pay the interest, most likely, and other issues, but at least we get that deferral. Now, this is the one that's good news for everybody. Actually, that other one is too. But your payroll tax deferral is no longer barred if you get your PPP loan forgiven. If you remember, under the rules that we had here, we're allowed to defer our Social Security taxes, employer Social Security taxes, the old age, survivors, and disability insurance, that is, those taxes other than Medicare, any ones that we incurred from March 27th through the end of December, we're allowed to push forward. Well, okay, great. We can push those forward, and we don't need to actually pay them until the end, half of them at the end of 2021 and half of them at the end of 2020. Now, as I note, the IRS said you don't have to do this, because there is a lot of concern that, if you do this, a lot of companies will hit the end of next year and suddenly won't have the money to pay the tax. And yeah, I think there's a real concern about that. However, there was an article in Tax Notes this week that also mentioned that don't be surprised if there's not a real push at the end of 2021 as people notice this problem, if there's not a real push to get these things just totally forgiven. So if you're thinking that's going to happen, then you defer regardless, right? And say, I'll just take my chances. That's an interesting problem. We'll have to see how all of this plays out in the future is wide open. But let me make it very clear. There's absolutely nothing in this bill that says we are going to get full-blown forgiveness of these payroll taxes. You know, that's speculation. And again, I think the speculation is not totally, I think there's enough to think it might happen, but I also think you better be very clear that it's not absolutely clear it's going to happen, and there's a very good chance it won't. So I wouldn't just do it for that. But in any event, previously, as soon as I got forgiveness on a PPP loan, I had to stop deferring. I couldn't defer my payroll taxes once I got that forgiveness. Now we're going to change the rule. So under the new rule, we're allowed to go ahead and this deferral of old age, survivor, and disability insurance is allowed regardless of whether or not we got a PPP loan deferred, or I should say forgiven. None of that matters. We're going to get everything. So bottom line, this part of the program is open to everybody now forever. So this is one to have that discussion with people about doing it, and you want to use it. And I mean, I would mention that, the discussion's already come up about, maybe we'll have to forgive this. And I'm not saying they will. Make very clear to your client or your boss that you are not saying they will do it. But there is a possibility. So now it becomes a big issue for us to figure out what's happening. Okay, all this great. So we got answers. No, we got a whole bunch more questions. All of the guidance we've had before has been under the old program. Now we have a brand new program. So the SBA is going to have to issue brand new guidance for us before we know for sure. A question I have gotten multiple times already. Does this mean we are going from 850 seconds to 2450 seconds for the maximum owner compensation? My own take on that right now, I'm hopeful we're doing that, but I could see the SBA deciding against it, believing that since we only got 2.5 months worth of payroll, that owners shouldn't be able to, get a benefit beyond some reasonable period. So maybe they'll go beyond 8 weeks, but maybe they won't go all the way to 24 weeks. So maybe we'll get some sort of cap there, because the theory being we don't want owners paid and the rank and file left out in the cold. I could see at least their justification that way. I do strongly believe that the maximum does have to go up to what's going to be essentially three times we had before, because that's in the actual law, and that seems hard-coded there. And once the covered period became three times longer, that pretty much means the max per employee should grow to three times what we had before. But again, we don't know until the SBA actually gives us guidance on this issue. I mentioned this already. Is interest now forgiven if it wasn't before? In the guidance we got from the SBA for the PPP loan program, you know, we got some indicated that interest would be forgiven. Then we got later that said, no, it wouldn't. And now we got this new law that's getting this deferral period, but it's a deferral period. You know, what's the real answer? And that's more an answer we were waiting on before because we had contradictory guidance. Well, that answer, we're going to need a little bit more, right? And the other catch is going to be, whoops, went to the wrong place. I love it. I went too early. Do pre-PPFA borrowers have to meet the 60% cliff? And the other key question we got to ask ourselves is, even though, you know, Senator Rubio seems to have indicated now that, yeah, Congress believed it was a cliff, is the SBA going to rule it's a cliff, or will they just make 60 like 75? We're not sure how that's going to go. Okay. Well, that's the brand new loan program. And if that's all you tuned in this week for, then, you know, you can basically end now. But there were some other things that happened this week, so I wanted to go over to with you. First thing is we did get some relief for qualified retirement plans. This is notice 2020-42. It was issued on June the 4th. And this deals with the fact that in many cases, certain elections made by a participant in a retirement plan, you need to have a notarized consent, or you have to do it in front of the plan, a plan representative. Because some of these things, you know, like spousal consents are the big ones. So if I want to take a distribution other than a joint survivor annuity in a form other than that, most often I need my spouse's consent if I'm married to take that particular distribution. And because, believe it or not, people are known to forge those things. The law says, tough luck, you need to actually either get this in front of a notary and have it notarized, or you need to have it signed in front of the plan administrator after your spouse proves they're your spouse, shows ID, etc. Well, obviously now with social distancing, a number of states have allowed notaries to not have to be physically present to notarize certain documents, in essence, to apply them. They've set up systems for remote notarization. And there's still the problem that do you really want to force these people into a room to meet this person for the plan administrator, or can we use some sort of, you know, some remote access software like right now? This is delayed, obviously, and taping will not work. But obviously, you know, you and I are not in the same room, but you're able to see me because we're using, you know, communications technologies. I'm using a webcam, and we're using the internet to make these changes. Can I use something like Zoom or Microsoft Teams or Google Meet or one of those things to get this taken care of? And so what they've said is, you know, we really need to do this, but we're going to do it for 2020 only. So the first thing to remember is the relief I'm about to tell you only applies for this year. We get to January 1st, 2021, unless they extend this period, which if we do have a COVID-19 problem in the middle of winter, don't be surprised if it gets extended. But for right now, it's not, you know, it's right now, it only ends at the end of December. If the state you are in has come up with a remote authorization rule for notaries, and so you got to kind of check to see if that exists, as long as you effectively comply with those rules, a notarization applied by a notary authorized by state law, you know, to that election using the remote procedures required by the state will be deemed to be acceptable for these purposes. Now, the other option is instead of a notary, we can have this done by a plan representative. And so what they did there was actually set up some rules for that. Because in this case, you know, the government has to actually, in this case, the feds are actually involved in doing this. So what happens in this case for physical presence, the individual who signs this relief has to show them, like here online, you would have to like hold up in front of the camera a copy of like my driver's license. And I'm not going to hold mine up because obviously, you know, there's personally identifying information on there that would be best not shown to the internet. But you would show that on a secure channel to the plan administrator. The plan administrator would then be able to take that and say, okay, I understand you're there. Also, on this live video conference, right, it has to ask for direct interaction. So they make it very clear. You cannot just, like I couldn't sit here right now and let's say I was signing an authorization under this program. I can't show the ID number to you here on the screen and then show you me signing it and then send this tape over. You know, that's not going to be good enough. It's going to have to actually be a live interaction so that the plan administrator can see me. I'm going to have to transmit by fax or electronically scan it, send it over to the admin, upload it to the plan administrator, sign that, you know, the actual signed document. I got to transfer that back over, which I could actually do by taking a picture of it under these rules. It would work. I know you all hate when clients take pictures of things and send those in as documents, but in this case, it would apparently work as much as you hate it. And then the administrator would note, document everything about this, note how they had done this, provide evidence of the remote copy being done, put that into their files, and then also send a copy of that back to the person who had signed the document. So everything would be taken care of under this procedure. Again, it only works through the end of December. And as I said, if you're going to do it for a notary purpose, you got to check and make sure state law works on it. Now, the next thing they had was they actually expanded the amount of relief for qualified opportunity funds. Okay, and we got a bunch of different relief periods in here that were expanded. And the main one, I think, for most of us here, because most of us have people potentially investing in them, but not necessarily running a QOF. If you are, there are a bunch of things running that I think I should worry about here later, but that's there. Previously, you were told that if your QOF 180-day reinvestment period ended between April 1st of 2020 and July 14th of 2020 or July 15th of 2020, you essentially were timely if you reinvested by the 15th of July. Well, what they're telling us now is we're going to extend that period all the way out to the end of December. So what's happening now is so long as your reinvestment period, right, you know, was there and was in time, you're able to get all the way to December. So if your client was scrambling right now because we're getting here at the beginning of June, your client scrambling is saying, well, you know, nothing's happening still. I can't get this reinvested. They have the right now to wait all the way until the end of December. Could this be extended again? Yeah, it could be extended again. Now, most of the other stuff in here is strictly limited to actual QOFs that are operating. So, for instance, there is a 90% standard for QOFs for the business test, and it's either when we get into a couple of time frames we're supposed to check to make sure we have 90% of our assets are in qualified assets in our QOF. If that testing date falls between April 1st, 2020 and December 31st of 2020, you ignore it. Okay, so we're not going to have to worry about having that done in that standpoint. That can simplify it. We're also going to find that the, you know, we got that first six-month test, year-end test is in there. Also, the working capital safe harbor, that's for a brand new qualified operating business getting started. They, you know, they can treat the reasonable working capital, not going to be a financial asset for an extended period of time. Well, there's a special rule that says if there's disaster, we can add up to 24 months to that period. What they're telling us now is, hey, not surprisingly, this is going to be considered one of those disasters. You'll be able to expand it. We're also getting clearance here on the 30-month period for substantial improvement. Remember, property is supposed to, the initial use is supposed to begin with the Qualified Opportunity Fund. And the problem is if you buy a brand new, if you buy an existing building, you know, somebody else used it. So you're allowed to, if you do a substantial improvement within 30 months, you're able to treat that as brand new, you know, as basically first use. Now they're saying if that 30-month period, we're going to totally disregard any period that comes from April 1st of 2020 through the end of this year will be disregarded. So it's like that time period doesn't exist. So you get 30 months plus the period from April 1st to December 31st, as long as you had ended your 30-month period before that date, okay? And there's a special rule that if your QOF disposes of its qualified investment, let's say the qualified business stock or whatever, or gets a distribution that's considered impartial liquidation, it's able to reinvest within 12 months. Well, we now get a special rule that says that particular reinvestment period, it now goes for an additional 12 months if the reinvestment period includes the period that ends on January the 20th, 2020. That allows us to get that done. Okay. Now, the other big thing that's happening here is we are going to get something unrelated you may have forgotten about. But remember a year ago, there was a really, really big fight that went over when the IRS came up and said, we want to use tax basis capital on the K-1. And there was a lot of complaining and discussion about the problems that would have and that some partnerships couldn't meet that. So the IRS backed off requiring tax basis capital only on K-1s for 2020 or for 2019 returns. It said, well, if it's negative, you still got to tell us, just like you did for 18, but we're not going to mandate it. We're going to give you more guidance later. So the idea was, they said initially, they were just going to release information on how the one way to do the calculation. Now they've decided maybe one way isn't the way we should be going on this. Rather, maybe we need to do some options. So what they're going to do is they're going to give us two options here. We can either use what's called the modified outside basis method to determine partners' capital, partners' tax basis capital, or the modified previously taxed capital method. Now, obviously, this is a proposed set of rules, but it's pretty clear they expect to use this proposal on 2020 partnership returns. So if you've forgotten about all of this because everything else has been happening, the IRS hasn't forgotten, right? They're still here and they're saying, we still want this. Now, they do explain in the notice, they understand, they talk about some of the problems they've had with this being a problem. And they actually come down and decide that the actual straight up way you normally record partners' capital, and this may complicate you if you have been doing partners' capital, you know, if let's say tax basis capital has been what you've been using, they're actually saying that the straight transactional approach will not be allowed anymore. So that may actually complicate matters for those of you that have always been keeping your partnership's capital accounts tax basis. May not be as bad a problem as you might think. We'll talk about the two methods, but it certainly is a method. It certainly is an issue that, you know, if you thought you were fine because we always did tax basis capital, may not be so fine. Just warning you, you know, we've got that. It may not be so fine. Well, let's talk about the two methods here. First is the proposed modified outside basis method. And this realizes that a lot of people who are preparing partnership returns are also maintaining basis calculations for the individual partners. Okay? Well, if you're doing that, then you can use this method. So I think a lot of firms will end up using this method. You take the partner's basis calculation for their outside basis. And all we're going to do is we're going to adjust that for debt allocated. Remember, you know, their share of partnership debt is considered to be part of their basis and would be an outside basis calculation. The IRS doesn't want that for capital. So they're telling you, go ahead and take that off. Take, you know, pull off the debt. Make sure the debt's not in there. Now, this is all good, but sometimes things happen and you don't know. Your partnership may not know a transaction has taken place. So they will include a requirement, apparently include a requirement. So far, they haven't told us how they're going to enforce it. But if a partnership is using the modified outside basis method, the partners will be required to give a notification in with certain events. The example they use in regulation is a partner sells their interest to another party. The acquiring partner will have to tell the partnership how much they paid for the interest and notify them that they had this, right? So that'll require some back and forth with the partners. Again, for some partnerships you work with, probably that's not gonna be a problem at all. You know about all that anyway. Other cases may be a little more interesting, right? So they've got it. Now, the other method we've got is this modified previously taxed capital method. And this is a method they had mentioned in the FAQs they sent out last year before this was done. In fact, both of these were kind of mentioned as optional methods. But this method takes a look at the calculations that we make under Regulation 1.743-1D1. Now, for those of you that don't speak regs, what we're talking about there is what you calculate when there is a 754 a 74 election has been made by a partnership, and let's say a partner sells their interest, or a partner inherits, some partner dies, their interest is inherited by another party. This is what you probably refer to 9 out of 10 times as the 754 adjustment. In reality, 754 handles a couple of sections. This is technically the adjustments under 743. But how you compute that adjustment is what you're going to use to back into what your partner's share of inside basis is. Now, if you haven't ever done this, and most people probably don't know the theoretically correct way to do it, it's one of those issues, but you're supposed to take a deemed sale of all partnership assets for cash, figure out what would that do, how would you record that in the partnership's books, and more importantly, how much cash would come out to each partner. You would take that partner's cash, and you would start with that as a starting point, but then you would reduce it by the gain you give them on their K-1 and increase it by any losses that came out on the K-1 as part of that sale. And if you think about what you're doing by subtracting gains and adding losses, you're actually restoring it back to tax basis, right? The basis inside. Now, the only problem with that is we don't normally have fair value for every asset. And the IRS recognizes that, yeah, you probably won't have the sale data. So they do allow us to use other methods, you know, an assumed sale for GAAP, you know, book value under GAAP, an assumed sale for 704 basis, you know, 704B basis, all kinds of options. You just got to tell them how you're doing it. However you're doing it, you tell them how you're doing it, right? You can use those bases. And we're going to assume all debt is non-recourse. So we're not going to get into this question of, well, the fair market value of the asset currently is, you know, $500, the debt on it's $1,000, you know, or our basis is, let's say, our GAAP net book value is $500, and that'd be a shortfall, and we don't have enough money to pay the debts. We're going to assume that we're always going to sell property effectively under these rules for at least the debt that secures them. So that will allow us to come back and back into, because what they're saying is really none of that makes a difference, because that would change your gain computed, and then we're still going to back that stuff off, gain or loss, so who cares? Just do it that way. Now, if you use this method, they think it's going to be the less used method, obviously. They will require the partnership to make a number of disclosures on the return. Other thing this notice makes clear, you can switch from one method to another each year, but you do have to put every year a reconciliation of how you got from ending partner's capital last year under the whatever method you used to beginning capital this year under the new method. You got to reconcile why there are differences. So you probably won't want to spend a lot of time making these changes. So just be aware of that. That's there. Well, we've gone on for a while today, but we are going to be doing CPE courses again. We're back in here. And I'll this week be doing 3 days of full 8-hour, two days of 8-hour sessions, which will be on the 8th and the 10th, 1 day of 2 4-hour sessions for the Arizona Society of CPAs. You can check that out on their website. I'll be doing 3 days of A&A guidance, actually for the Oregon Society of CPAs on June 17th, 18th, and 19th. And I will be doing a full 8 hours on all of this fun we've had with tax changes and CARES Act updates and all the other fun we've had this year. I'll be doing that for Illinois Society, 8 hours on June the 23rd. As you may suspect, all of these are virtual sessions, right? You know, it's going to be virtual whether you like it or not. We're going to be here in the virtual sessions. Like I said, for a lot of you in Arizona, probably about over half the people who would sign up for the course would have been outside the place anyway. So half of them, it's no big change. Half, it's going to be a big change. For those of you in Oregon and for those of you in Illinois, yeah, it's virtual. I will be doing it from here in Phoenix. In fact, one of the Arizona courses was originally supposed to be held in Tucson. Obviously, there's little point in me going to Tucson to do a webcast that nobody in Tucson, you know, I'd just be sitting in Tucson to do it. So we're obviously doing that from here this time. So we'll be doing it locally. So be sure you're there. Be sure you take that. If you are taking webcasts now, the one thing I strongly suggest, if you have not done so in the past, or even if you're using a brand new, you know, you haven't, let's say your society has not been using webcasts, you're starting to use their systems or using a different one, it's always best on every webcast to show up a little bit early. Some of the things that happen that cause webcasts to go south if you're participating is, number one, your computer is running some sort of a deep scan from your security software because you turned it on 2 minutes before you want to go in the webcast, and that will tend to cause all kinds of problems because your computer's too busy to actually handle showing the webcast. Also, your computer might decide it's time to update. If you have a laptop, you do webcast, you're going to do webcasts on, but it's not one you usually use, so you haven't had it on for the last 2 weeks. There's a real good chance when you turn it on, it's going to want to do a Windows update. That could cause problems. And third, it just gives you time. If you come in a half hour early and you've got a problem and you recognize there's a problem, you can get a lot better tech support than if you're there with the mob 1 minute into the broadcast and everybody who has problems 1 minute into the broadcast calling at the same time, they're all panicking. So yeah, give yourself a little time. It usually works better if you do it that way. I'm just warning you ahead of time. Also, I strongly suggest you check the speed of your connection. If you go to fast.com, Netflix uses that for their testing for people, if people call with an issue. But fast.com, if you go there and you're watching a webcast, if you run that test under conditions that are what you expect when you're taking the webcast, you know, if you start seeing numbers there in the low single digits megabits per second, you may have trouble, right? And you might be having trouble because everybody in your office or everybody everywhere, everybody in your house is, you know, doing a lot of streaming of 4K content. There's lots of reasons. But you want to check that out, and you want to try to figure out how to get that number up. For real safety, I'd like to see numbers, if I'm doing one, I'd like to see them above 10. Again, it should work fine at about 1.8 to 3. Should work just fine for most everything. But it's always best if you have a little more, you have a little extra room, so something goes down temporarily, you won't have a problem. In any event, this has been the update for this week of June the 6th. You can catch our regular updates online at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. We're there. You can also send questions or comments to me, Ed Zollers, at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Ed Zollers is the location you'll find me that. And also, I do follow discussions. I'm on the boards that you'll find for the Connect sites, for the state societies for Arizona, Illinois, New Jersey, and Minnesota I check into. Also, I watch Cal CPA's Tax Talk group, which any CPA in the country can join. And I also do take a look every so often at Reddit, at the /r/taxpros. Now, make sure if you go there, you don't go to /r/taxes, because that one is a little more interesting, and that's where you're going to get all of the people seeking free tax help. Tax pros, that's not usually our issue. So, as I said, we want to kind of thank you for being here this week. We want to hopefully you'll take a look and you'll consider tuning in for us next week as we talk about more new development issues. And we know that the SBA has got to give us some guidance down on this. They're probably going to have to revise those 30 FAQs they have ready to make them comply with the new law. But I wouldn't be surprised to see some guidance, and we're going to still be an interesting time, interesting week, lots of things happening with these programs. And now clients who got their loans earlier are going to have to start working on how do we work with them, and how are they impacted by this. So lots happening. So go ahead, be sure to come back here and tune in next week for more current federal tax developments.